All right, good morning, everybody. We are going to get started on our Community Corrections Partnership meeting for Wednesday, September 19, 2012. Sorry, we started a little bit late. They're setting up refreshments right now outside the doors, just on tables out there. So if anybody would like water or, you know, any sprues or anything like that, we may go out at any time and get that. And to convene the CCP, we need roll call.
We have Chief Cougay.
Here.
Judge Bush.
Terry McNally for Judge Bush.
District Attorney Green.
Yeah.
Public Defender Titus.
Conrad Moore for Mr. Titus.
Sheriff Youngblood.
Present.
Director Dr. Waterman. I know I struggle with that. Sorry. You're here. Chief Williamson.
Here.
Director Alvarez.
Here.
Director Cheadle. Not here. Executive Director Corson.
Here.
Supervisor Goh.
Here.
Director Lewis.
Here.
Superintendent Lizardi Frazier. Here. Division Director Miracle.
Here. Okay, first up on the agenda will be looking at the consent agenda, which there are usually none on these on our agendas, which once again is not on here. So we will move on to number one, which is the approval of the minutes for both June 27th and the July 11, 2012 meeting. Are there any questions, comments regarding the minutes? Did everybody get a chance to look those over? Dr. Water.
I seem to be the minute complainer. Minutes, in my opinion, minutes are summaries. Our discussion was taken and then a recording of what actions are taken. I think we went through this before when we had a 50-page verbatim thing that we said at that time that our minutes would be summary minutes. So,
well, Dr. Mark, that is on our agenda to discuss about changing the way we do the minutes to make them shorter, and but that will be a discussion later. But yeah, I agree with you. They're way too long, I think, and. But we will, that will be a discussion on the later agenda item. So that will come up, but I appreciate the comment. And it actually did start out because of your statement the last time, and that's why we're changing it. But we didn't want to change it until, I'm not saying that, but I think you're correct. But we didn't change it because we hadn't made a decision yet in the committee. So we had to keep it safe. So Supervisor Goh.
Are we commenting specifically on corrections right now?
Yes. Any corrections that you would like to make? Or
627 on page 7, just my statement about she does not understand. I did understand, so I know I didn't use that word, but I don't remember what it was.
I'm sorry. It was the 27th meeting?
27th, page 7, at the top, stated she does not understand the amount the PD receives as equivalent, and that just doesn't make sense to me. In the very last sentence, PD's argument does not support the revision. So I know I didn't say quite that, but I don't exactly remember what I said. It just doesn't make sense to me what is down there.
Okay.
And there were, yeah.
We will make those corrections.
Thanks. And then there's also, On 7-11, page 15, my comment also asked that the subcommittee need specific data have Ms. Jameson to prioritize. I'm not exactly sure.
Asked that the subcommittee needs specific data
have Ms. Jameson.
Ms. Jameson, do you remember what that comment was pertaining to?
Well, I know it was a discussion of what the gaps and the needs are, and that if they needed something that I could, based on the data information, that I could
prioritize those. Okay.
I remember something to that effect, but there's something about the way it's worded that just seems a lot.
Right.
So go back and check that, please. Thank you.
And hopefully in the future, these will not be an issue any longer. So, but anyway, but we will make that correction also. And just to clarify that statement, we will do that. Any other comments or statements regarding the minutes?
Can I ask our council if minutes, what the definition of minutes is? I've never seen minutes that are verbatim. Are these minutes?
I've seen the whole, through the chairman, I've seen the whole gambit of reported minutes. I've seen summaries such as this. As you can see, the minutes on the Board of Supervisors agenda, they're very concise. Basically, follow what the recommendation was and who spoke. So it's really up to the discretion of this body as to how much detail they want in the minutes.
And again,
and it appears to me that because we have so much detail, we're going to have issues like this, as Supervisor Gill brought up.
Correct. And that's why that is on the agenda for today's discussion, to talk about that. Supervisor.
And Chairman, may I ask Council one question?
Yes.
Council, would it be appropriate to abstain if we don't honestly feel we can recollect what's in the minutes?
That's within your discretion.
Thank you.
Or you can vote subject to revision by a staff and bring it back to the board.
I'm not concerned about my own statements. It's just all the rest that I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, who can, actually? Mia Green, did you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, then I will need a motion and a second to accept and approve the minutes for both meetings, prior meetings.
Second.
I have a motion by Mr. Miracle, a second by Sheriff Youngblood. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Any abstentions?
I'm abstaining. Are you doing them together?
No,
you are.
Yes, we were.
Well, I need to abstain from the meeting of the 11th because I wasn't for the 27th.
which one were you not there? Yeah.
27.
The 27th? Okay. And we will indicate that Dia Green is abstaining from the vote on the minutes for the 27th, but not the 11th July. And then we have an abstention from Director Cheadle, Director Director Alvarez, Dr. Waterman, and Supervisor Gill. And yes, and then the record should show that Director Cheadle is now present. Okay, now for public presentations, and please, I would ask that you try to stick to the 2-minute limit of any public presentations. And these are presentations that are not on the agenda for today, because there will be a discussion on those, and the public will have an opportunity to comment on those. So is there anybody out in the public that wish to make a statement, comments? Yes, and if you could approach the podium, state your name, where you're from, for the record, and we'd appreciate it.
Hi, my name is Derek Henry. I'm a parolee. I'm presently at Turning Point Reentry Program. Upon release from prison, the biggest challenges for it would probably be housing and maybe our job assistance and job training. Definitely those two. But a program like Turning Point has really been beneficial, though. Job searching and I mean, I would be lost without a program such as Turning Point, you know. Just a real good opportunity to, I guess, slowly get back into society and try to be a productive member.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm glad you're making that effort, and we appreciate that. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Anybody else?
Good morning. My name is Bridget Ray. Today I'm an employee of Turning Point of Central California, but the reason I'm here is usually when I stand in front of a crowd, I introduce myself to say, hello, my name is Brenda, and I'm an addict. I am coming up on 11 years, and I got a wonderful program when I got in trouble called PC 1000, and it changed my life. I don't have a background, so to speak, so I can pass those requirements to get a decent job. I don't even know if they have that program anymore. I just want you to know that, you know, meth was my problem, and it tore up my life for a lot of years. And today I belong to Narcotics Anonymous. I go into prisons, and that's a blessing not to have a background. And I talk about what they can do when they come out. I had a lot of struggles. I didn't get an in-house program. So that meant I had to try to find whatever job I could to go around all of my requirements. And I learned how to do that. And today I'm a good employee because of that. I went to the Stop Meth meeting, and thank you so much, because what I heard there was, you can't lock us up. We need treatment, you know. I had to do 2 meetings a week in Narcotics Anonymous and go to a counseling session. And it saved my life. It saved my children's life. You know, my grandchildren have never seen me loaded at all. They wouldn't even know what that meant to see grandma loaded. And so, you know, I want to thank the judge who sentenced me to my program. You know, at first it was a very hard struggle, and today I know that's exactly what I needed to become the person I am today. So I want to thank you for that, and I just wanted to let you know how I felt about this talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Ms.
Ray. Anybody else like to make a comment or presentation?
My name is Jeremy King, and I'm a parolee. The biggest challenge for me when I got out was basically getting a job. So I found a little program called New Life, and you know, I joined it, and hopefully I can make something out of that and get a job. But that's about it.
Okay,
well,
thanks.
Sure, it's Greg Williamson.
Sir.
Sir, I just want to ask you a couple questions. What are the difficulties that, because I'm being told, and I look in the paper, there's a lot of jobs available. What are the barriers that you find? Is it because you are a parolee, because you are a convict, because you have a felony conviction, or is there other reasons?
No, it's because
that? Your skill set, like, you need training, those types of things.
Basically, like, I guess everybody do background checks, so when they see you a felon, they give you less of a chance. You know, like, we limit it. We got to do hard work, like oil fields and
right.
construction. You know, we can't just get an office job or nothing.
Gotcha.
So,
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Mr. King, anybody else?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and panel members, and Lily and Pat and all my good friends up here. My name is Jan Castile, and I work for New Life Training Center. And I just wanted to invite 2 of our guys that are in our program to see government in action and see how things get planned around them more so than including them in the planning process. And so, you know, we want to try and hear from them, you know, what are issues for them. And they get a little nervous when they come up and talk to such powerful people. So they didn't get a chance to really tell you some of the things that, you know, that really impact their lives. But I'm also standing up here with another hat or another role, and that's to talk about the Safe Community Partnership. It was a partnership that we talked about to you a couple of meetings ago that we formed so that we could, so that community agencies could form a network so that we could provide support to the things that you are doing for AB 109, and mainly to provide support for ex-offenders who are coming back into our community who will be accessing our services and, you know, really trying to get an understanding of what their needs are and how we can better serve them and how we can support your efforts, you know, to make our community more safe. One of the 4, really 5 main objectives is to identify ex-offender needs, identify gaps in services, develop strategies to fill those unmet needs and to form this network of services. And so we've been meeting on a regular basis at least once a month, and we've really been having some really good turnout. We've had about 16 community agencies attend those meetings, and we've included ex-offenders in those meetings so that we can really see how we are, trying to build a structure for them. And probation has been there, a sheriff's department has been involved, and a lot of representatives from some of our public agencies have been involved. We had I think one of the most important things that we did was we had a panel discussion, and the panel discussion included ex-offenders, reentry program staff, and the probation department. And we asked four main questions of everybody that was there. And it was, what were the three greatest challenges or concerns when you were first released? What would have to ex-offenders? What would have helped you reintegrate into the community? What support services did you need? What support services did you really access? And how did you find out about those services? And what services do you wish were available? Those were the four questions. We asked probation, based on your experience, what are the three greatest unmet ex-offender needs? What are the top three barriers ex-offenders face when reintegrating into the community? And how does your agency address those barriers? And what unmet needs is your agency unable to fill? We also had some discussion with those agencies that were involved along with our ex-offenders around six main topics: housing, employment, basic needs, support services, substance abuse, reporting requirements. And then we came up with some suggestions that we want to share with this committee. And what we looked at were how can we make some changes without money? And also, how can we make some changes if we had money? And so we did a process called the spin the dot. And we gave each person five dots, and we color-coded the dots. And we said, don't think about money. If you could make any changes that you wanted to make and see any progress that you wanted to see in the community with the ex-offenders, how would you spend that money? So basically ended up being about $1,000 a dot. And so we came up with some really insightful information that we'd like to share our outcomes with. We have a little, it's not so little, but it is our findings, very interesting stuff, especially things around that we thought that could change within the departments. One of those things was waiving of fees, some of the fees that ex-offenders have to pay when they get out, and they have no job, they have no place to live, and they have no way of making money, but they have to pay these fees for court-mandated programs. And if there was some kind of way that those fees could get reduced or waived so that they could participate, and then also some of the mandatory programs that require that they participate right in the middle of the day, maybe twice a week when they're trying to look for a job, look for a house, get into training, and those kind of things like that. Really insightful information that we just wouldn't have thought of, you know, from their perspective. And one of the things that when we're talking about ex-offenders, we don't remember that there are women ex-offenders. And the issue of trying to regain custody of your child is a big issue for them while they're trying to get in school or while they're trying to get a job, and then attending some of these mandatory classes and stuff that they have to attend. And then finally, reporting to probation is a real big issue when you're looking for a job, or if you get in a training program such as New Life, you have to stop in the middle of the week, stop in the middle of the training or day, and go report to your probation officer because they don't make house calls unless you're messing up. So if we could look at doing off hours, weekend reporting, or some of these programs doing off hours while people are trying to help them and while they're trying to help themselves, those were some of the suggestions. Unfortunately, this is kind of like an ad hoc committee. I mean, there's no money for our committee, and so we don't have money to print this. So what we would like to do is to share this with each of you, but we'd like to give it to Becky so that Becky can make a copy and share it with you, if that's okay. All right, thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Supervisor Joe.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Ms. Castile, for sharing that. In the document that we're receiving, does it talk about the attendees there and the diversity of agencies represented? I'm just curious.
Yes, it does. It gives a list of the agencies that were involved in participating. And we'd like to invite any of the community agencies. I mean, we sent out our email list is huge. It takes us about half an hour or more to just get the email out. But we haven't gotten everybody that we need. And so we're looking at who needs to be at the table, you know, because we want to make this a whole community effort. And one of the outcomes when we spend the dot and spent our money, the agencies really felt that it was important that that we come together and develop a master plan that would support the AB 109 master plan, a community master plan. How can the community come together and really work on these issues? Because we know it's not just the criminal aspect, it's the social issues, it's the health issues, it's all the other, you know, complex social issues that, you know, that we have to deal with. And so we all want to come together.
Thank you. My question really related more specifically to just the whether the data reflects a broad spectrum, or was it heavily weighted towards a number of the same people from agencies attending? So I'm just trying to get a better sense. If that's all clear in the information that we're getting, then that's great. I'm just trying to get a better understanding. When we look at data, is this a broad representation of our community, multiple perspectives, or is it focused more on the opinions of those who had similar experiences?
Well, I mean, I'm not real clear about what you really want, but I can tell you that there was business representation there, there was representation from public agencies, and there was representative from nonprofit agencies, and there was ex-offender representation. So if there needs to be more descriptive of that, we put a list of who actually attended and who participated. And if you need more, and we don't really have numbers in terms of data. We have, you know, our stuff is more qualitative. It was around discussions, answering those really hard questions, and getting feedback. So if you need more, you know, something more in depth, just let me know.
Thank you.
Okay.
Lily. Director Alvarez, I'm sorry.
I had another question regarding fee waivers. And so are those for programs that are required, and are they listed specifically in there? So
yes, they are. One is the STEP. And domestic violence. The other one was, let me see, Prop 36 testing. They have to pay for the drug testing on their own. They have to come up with those fees. So those fees continue to place a hardship on them when they don't have money to buy food or clothing or transportation. You know, these are fees that they have to come up with. You know, and so if there could be either a reduction or a waiver, especially when they're first getting out, you know, so that that doesn't happen. And another thing was, if there was some kind of way that probation could spend some of their money to buy a bus pass, but they wanted to make sure that the bus pass had that individual's name on it some kind of way, so they couldn't sell it. So, I mean, that was one of the issues. And it's just those kind of small things that really help probationers to, you know, to make it on the streets.
It's just the public defender, Moore, has what?
Thank you, Ms. Castile. You spoke about no-cost options also. And I'm hopeful that one of the things that New Life focuses on is interview techniques. And I'd specifically like to hold up that the first gentleman who spoke and compliment the professionalism of your dress here today in terms of wearing a nice shirt, tie, slacks, nice shoes. That I think really speaks well to projecting professionalism and respect in the business community. And I think giving tips to those folks who maybe did not have the benefit of what employers look for in terms of presenting themselves will go a long way to positioning folks favorably to get employment. And I think that is a no-cost option that really can be beneficial.
Thank you, Conrad. And I want to apologize for the two guys come. They asked me, should they dress up? And I said, well, you just got in the program. I need you to come the way that you are. And then, you know, as you go proceed further to then be able to come back and say, this is what I learned. So I apologize because they wanted to dress up. They wanted to come suited and booted. And I said, no, we want you to, you know, we want you to come, you know, we wanted people to see you on the level that you are right now, you know, to deal with you right now, because a lot of people are afraid of them and so on like that. And just wanted to let them know, this is the governing body that makes decisions for you, about you and your future. And you need to tell them how you feel about it, but you need to let them see how you really are. And so, you know, while we do, as certainly at New Life and Conrad, you know, we always refer to you with our clients. And so, I didn't mean to let the cat out the bag, but, you know, that's one of the things that we certainly do is we do job readiness and job prep. And thanks to Pat, we have a contract, a small contract, that helps us get that together. So the guys that come in our program, we've served over about 150 guys over the last 3 or 4 years. And when they get to our program, they know what's up. So, you know, the first thing we do is we get them in a uniform, we level the playing field, no bling, no sagging, and all of that. These guys are just getting in the program straight off the streets. And the reason why they're here is because we have this big West Tech training going on at our facility right now, and they've already taken West Tech. So again, my apologies, Conrad, for not having our guys suited and booted. Okay.
Ms. Castillo, I just want to say, I do like the way you start out. It's not just finding the job, it's getting them ready. You know, mentally, everything, just to get them ready to be prepared to take the job. But I do have one question. You have a residential part of it.
Yes, we do.
Have you been able to open that up yet?
We are looking at an open date on
October 1st.
Wow. I'm going to let the person who's handling that, my boss.
Oh, man. So you see, Jen, you know that's not true, right? Good morning. My name is Sonia Jeffrey, and I am the project consultant for the residential facility for New Life. And we will be ready October 1st with 24 beds. We just completed the process of hiring our staff, and we are readying the facility right now, the last minute touches. We're looking for agencies to refer. Right now, because we do not have any funding to support individuals, we're looking at individuals who have the resources to pay for the room and board or transitional housing. It's $675 a month. That includes room, board, case management services, the pro social skills and the life skills, the referring to employment services, doing assessments, developing the individual case management plans, and then the final goal is to help them transition into permanent housing and employment. We'll be having a grand opening on October 25th, and we'll be getting that information out to you within the next week.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Okay, anybody else from the public would like to speak?
My name is Joseph Gomez, employee at Turning Point, case manager. I would like to actually bank off of Ms. Brenda's statement about actually being a drug addict and going through the programs. I would like to give a testament to, I'm a son of a drug addict, that because of a program like Turning Point, helping them, you know, obtain skills, helping them overcome the drug addiction, that I never had to experience that lifestyle. I never had to grow up in a gang environment. You know, I had a dad. You know, for a short amount of time, my dad was a drug addict. But as I was growing up, but today he's 25 years clean. He's a senior pastor at Victory Outreach Church, and I never had to see that. I never had to grow up around drugs, and it was because of a program like Turning Point that he went to jail. He did time, and it didn't do nothing for him. It was programs like Turning Point and New Life and Victory Outreach that gave him that help he needed. It's more of a transformation. It's not just a you go to jail and do time and you're going to be okay. You know, you got to, there's a process to go through to get that change. And like I said, I just wanted to give you a testament that I never had to do drugs. I never drank a beer. I never smoked a cigarette. I never smoked anything. And because of his decision to go to a program and change his life, my brother's never had to see that. My little brother, he's never experienced it. So it's just, I congratulate Turning Point and New Life and Victory Outreach and programs like us for doing all that we do for the little we receive. And it's because of our compassion to see the change. And the reason why I got into this field was not because of the money, because there's no money in it.
That's right.
It's because of the passion we have to see it, them change. And like I said, I stand here to testify to that these programs do work. And we don't do it for the money. We do it, well, although it helps us. Money makes the world go around. I mean, money helps us get the stuff we need. Money helps us give these guys nice clothes and job readiness. And we have a job developer on site. And we prepare these men to go out and sit down and interview. But it's because of programs like this that, you know, we sacrifice a lot of our time and things we could be doing, but we do it for this individual right here and these individuals back here. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else from the public like to make a statement?
Good morning. My name's Dr. Mary Sawyer, and I didn't come expecting to speak this morning, but having heard all of these friends stand up and speak to you, I thought I would say hello. I own Portfolio Properties and Portfolio Property Management and Acme Maintenance Company. I am a for-profit business owner in this community. I've come alongside the Kern County Homeless Collaborative and joined their board. They immediately put me on every committee that they could sign me up for, as well as Kern County Mental Health, Behavioral Health Board, and I'm on the Housing Committee. And so I know Dr. Waterman and Ms. Alvarez. It's nice to see so many of you around here that I know. I started attending some of the meetings and was invited here by Ms. Jameson. I went to the meeting of which these ladies are speaking, the Safe Partnership, and let me tell you, it was amazing to see how they were collecting input from various people in the community. And to answer Supervisor Goh's question, the data was heavily over to one side skewed because it was a lot of agencies that were there. Sheriff Youngblood, you had four of your commanders there, people that are the patrol, Bill Wheeler, people like that, and they were really learning a lot about what the dialogue around the table on this topic of AB 109 is. I was the only dot that was red because I was the only business person in the room, and there were probably 70 people. So what does that tell you? Business owners that are for profit are not getting involved in this because there's no profit for them to get involved unless they have another reason. And that is because they're part of a community and they want to make this community stronger. Everyone says there is no money. Well, business people don't look at it that way. We just make money. We just go out there and we make some money. How do we do that? We employ people. So as an employer, I want to say to parole, please get some evening hours. Have your people staffed in the same brick and mortar in the evening so that those parolees, those clients that you serve who are working, have a job, can keep that job. Because I want to tell you, when I'm employing someone, and especially if they're a minimum wage or an entry-level person or a person with special needs, that I have to make special considerations for, when I have to let them take off to go for a meeting and come back, and it's 3 hours, right out of the chunk of a day, when they're working on doing something that had to be painted and screwed together and assembled so the next person can complete their part of that production or that job, we have a problem. So I'm saying to you, this is something you can do. It doesn't cost any more money. Make a shift that's working in the evenings or the weekends so that those people who have a job can keep their job. So let's see. I think those are the key points that I wanted to say. make a request. Get us involved. Invite the business people to come to these kinds of meetings to get our opinion and to see what we can do to help come alongside of you, because we all know that this is going to take a community to address this issue. One of the things I provide is housing. I don't see any other landlords getting involved at this level. I'm the only one there, and sometimes the agencies are surprised to see me there. They're happy to see me there. One of the decisions my company made January 1st is that we were going to look beyond the barriers to entry to housing for felons and special needs populations, including the homeless and the chronically homeless, those medically fragile people that are at risk of dying on the streets this year. And I said, how can I do this? You may know that it's illegal to discriminate on many bases, including disability. But yet landlords do. And the barrier that they hold is the financial barrier. You have to make 2.5 times the rental amount to be able to qualify for the apartment, right? That's what it is. And you can do a background check. And if anything comes up that shows that they have a problem, you can discriminate on that. So what we agreed to do in my company is to lower that barrier if they have two things. One, a payee, and the second one is case management. Because we know that with case management, somebody has a hand on that individual, and that's going to help them become a better neighbor and renter and be successful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, anyone else from the public like to make a presentation? Okay, I see none. We will move on to item number 3, which is the chairman's report. Mine will be very short. The only thing I have to report out on was that at Dr. Waterman's request, I did send out a letter to Senator Rubio to thank him for his support and all this, and I believe all of you received a copy of that letter and the attachments I sent. So that did go out to Senator Rubio's office. So, and I want to thank you for that suggestion, because that was an excellent idea. He has been a big supporter of ours in this valley. So I just wanted to let you know that. And so that's the end of my report. All right, number 4, the CCP committee member announcements or report. Anybody on the committee has a report?
I have one real quick, TR Miracle. Part of your packet is a memo to the CCP for myself. It was basically an internal survey of all of our probation officers, of them listing the services that they felt our clients would most benefit from. And it's just I won't go over it here, but it's just a synopsis of what those top 4 needs that the probation officers themselves felt were important. They were employment services, residential substance abuse treatment, transportation, and transitional housing. And the only other thing I have to report is we're going to have a day reporting center graduation on October 19th. And that's the thing where we have a dinner and a lot of the graduates talk about their experience at the day reporting center. It's pretty impactful to hear from the clients themselves. So if anyone is interested in attending that, just let me know and we can set that up.
Okay, any other committee members would like to report out or make it known? Dr. Waterman.
I had a conversation with a mental health director from a Bay Area county. I found it fascinating because, as you know, the formulas were changed based upon the theory that the Bay Area counties are so much more progressive in terms of a rehabilitation approach than us.
Exactly, yes.
And they got, so their county, I believe it was Alameda, got 3 times.
More than 3 times, yeah. Right. They received $9 million the first year.
But in their allotment of funds, when they went through the same process we went through at our last committee meeting, mental health and substance abuse got 0 in their county.
Really?
Yes. And I just found that really fascinating because there was sort of this self-righteous tone to the whole discussion, and then they turned around and really didn't support their rehabilitation-oriented agencies in that county. So just thought that was interesting. I thought I'd share that.
And next, me and I go to for the Chiefs. I will use this information. I just, because I have been, actually, I've had contact with a few Bay Area news medias about, you know, about their argument that they're doing it right. And this information also helps, but I mean, I don't think they take other things into consideration that I feel is important. So anyway, but I appreciate that information. That's very interesting to know. Thank you, Dr. Waterman. Director Alvarez?
I'd just like to report that Kern County Mental Health Substance Abuse Treatment is now delivering the matrix model for women at Laredo. I think that's going to also make a difference in the way in which we're working with this, you know, in partnership with the Sheriff's Department. So we look forward to placing those women in treatment. And also, with a small grant, we probably will be able to find some housing that would also accept their children. So
any other report outs from committee members? I see none. Okay, we will move on to item number 5, which is the RFQ subcommittee recommendations. Mr. Forrest?
Chairman Kugan, thank you. Hopefully the handout is in the back that I'll be referring to as well. It should be in the packets. We'll try to make it as brief as possible. I'll tell you a little bit about the process. I do know more about this population than I did know prior. I appreciate especially Mr. Miracle and Becky and Kim back there who have sent me probably stacks and stacks of literature and other information. So I've done a lot of reading, as well as Ms. Cheadle and Ms. Frazier, who just got her first grandchild, so that's why she's not able to be with us today. The first thing that we did, of course, is we began to look at the literature that was out there and also made a request from mental health, probation, and the Sheriff's Department to provide us with what they were seeing internally as needs for pre- and post-release folks. And I was provided with a wealth of information from all those departments. From there, we tried to distill that information, as well as looking at the data that was out there. The research is really broad. You're beginning to see more and more of it being focused on California and what's happening with programs in California, AB 109. I did include, Becky did for me actually, in your handout, there is a little thing from Stanford Law that refers to Santa Clara. And this is more just for your reference. It's probably one of the most simplistic things that I've read about what other counties are doing in other programs. There is no perfect formula. We were really hoping that we could come back, especially with Mr. Waterman, and provide you that this is what you need to fund. Clearly, there's nothing else in the world that's going to make a bigger difference than this program. It's proven in evidence based. Unfortunately, we didn't find that, but what we did find is some trends. And actually, I heard some of those this morning. And so I appreciate the public comment. It makes me feel a little bit better that we're on track. We took that information, and Pat and Chris and I met. We began to look at it kind of twofold. One, we wanted to provide this group with enough information to be able to move forward, again, our RFP out. And two, we wanted to make sure that we had identified what we thought were some of those probably most important needs. I apologize for kind of reading some of this, but that way the audience doesn't have a handout. We met, but what we found was recidivism research consistently shows that improved access to housing, which, just so you guys know, continually comes up, especially the transitional housing. Employment, substance abuse treatment, behavioral skill training, basic need resources reduces the likelihood that individuals convicted of a low-level, nonviolent offense will commit a new crime. The field of research asserts the measurable decrease in recidivism and significant cost savings can be realized when evidence-based, research-based, and promising programs are utilized to provide them. To gain local insight into the needs of Kern County of pre- and post-released inmate service needs, we asked local stakeholders to provide both qualitative and quantitative needs assessment information, and the following gaps of service and needs were identified: shelter and transitional housing, domestic violence treatment, substance abuse treatment, job skills and employment readiness, GED and remedial studies, aggression replacement therapy, cognitive behavioral skills, and bridging that gap between custody of pre- and post-release and linking and supports. there are some other things that were there. I mean, we heard things like the need for bus passes and transportation. There needs to be able to identify veterans because there's specific programs that can work them out. But these were kind of the big top eight things. Neither current or local research needs assessment information point to the most critical need that should be provided. However, research does assert certain methods providing these services, example, evidence-based, research-based, and promising programs are most likely to result in measurable decreases in recidivism and cost savings. That being said, I really was hoping we'd find one program or kind of one model. We all know the answer in this room, and part of the frustration was, you know, there's a limited amount of dollars. But we continually hear from this group a commitment to supporting this community-based and the faith-based organizations. I did attempt to do a monkey survey. It was my first one. I like it because it has the word monkey in it, so that makes me happy. I got spanked by county council, and I do appreciate, too, we received additional feedback from monkey survey that TR was able to do. So, again, throughout this, we kept vetting our process and checking the literature and other things, and I got a big thing on my desk that I'm going to file after this meeting, hopefully, that I won't look at again for a while. But our recommendation to this group is that the funds available to meet pre and post inmate needs are limited, measurable outcomes are expected. It's recommended an RFP process that invites both CBOs, and that includes faith-based organizations, to submit proposals limited to the eight service types above, which I mentioned, and that the scoring process be utilized, of course, to identify which proposal holds the most promise for improved outcomes. Proposals that receive the highest scores should include the following: that will be provided by an agency CBO with the capacity and necessary experience to successfully implement and evaluate them. And just to note in the document regarding Santa Clara County, one of the things they did is set aside some of that money they designated for CBOs for the evaluation piece of those programs. They felt it was critical. If you had the money, that would be a great thing to do. Will be utilized evidence-based, research-based, or promising programs to provide those services proposed. Will be cost-effective, of course, in terms of numbers served. Will be integrated with other supportive services throughout Kern County, as demonstrated by an understanding of available community resources and partnerships with local agencies. Your collaborative is currently doing that now, and I congratulate you on that. And will be accessible to client in areas such as transportation, language, cultural diversity, ability to pay, etc., are factored in the service delivery model. So you can see why your comments to me made me feel good. It felt like, and hopefully Pat's feeling the same way. So we recommend that approach, even though we don't prioritize a service need type or assign specific funding dollar amounts to something, that at least for those eight kind of category areas that an RFP be issued, I would recommend, and I haven't talked to Pat about this, but I have talked to Chris, that those that are on RFP scoring panels come from the DA's office, public defender's office, sheriff, probation, mental health, and even ETR. And I think if you have that mix, you have experts in the room that will be brokering these services or referring their clients to those services, and I think they'll know what's best for their clients. I'm sorry it's not as black and white, but it is what it is. But again, throughout, and even other documents, including the one that Becky provided from Stanford Law School, kind of comes back to these topics again and again. But when you look at it from a common sense standpoint, kind of where I come from, if you're doing more pre-release with these folks, whether it's domestic violence, substance abuse treatment, preparing them to be released, and if they get released and they have a place to be, place to live, mm-hmm. then they're able to participate in the job skill programs, they're able to participate in the substance abuse, the therapy, and the other things they need, hopefully, to be successful and not give them. So with that, Mr. Kuge, that is the recommendation, and I don't know if Ms. Cheadle has anything she would like to add to my comments.
I think you covered it very well, thank you. And I'd like to thank Tom because he really took the leadership to bring Christine and I together, and so we just appreciate that.
And I just go over one more time the agencies you feel that should be on this panel. You said just DA, PD, mental health, probation, sheriff, ETR.
Those are the ones.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know that sounds like a lot. When we do, for instance, when we do RFP money out in the community, I have probation, I have someone for mental health, I have someone in the Department of Human Services. It just makes sense. And when I say mental health, Lily, just know I see you as part of that family at the family dinner with mental health. but I mean, everybody, I mean, I would think that even Lisa Greenstaff, they may not be necessarily referring a client to Portland, I don't know if they do, but as they're making recommendations to the courts, they know what services are out there. But I will say, I mean, the Sheriff's Department staff, these guys, probation, mental health, Steve, you sent me, you know, huge amount of documentation and stuff. I appreciate the work. I mean, you guys, you know, really provided me with good information. I think mirrors what I've seen up and down the state and throughout the nation. And if you need to know some websites to go to, ask him, always.
Okay, Dr. Waterman.
Are we going to, I mean, this is something I don't understand this morning. Are we going to take this money and do one RFP and look for providers that do the whole gamut of your priorities, or are we going to break it into pieces and do an RFP that's housing related and that's domestic violence related, and that, you know, I mean, what are you suggesting? Yeah.
That was kind of my question, right, too. I don't think one agency can do it all, so no. How are we going to?
No, my recommendation would be that the RFP would state these are the kinds of things that you're looking for, and it may be that you fund one program. It may be that you fund four programs. I mean, that's kind of where we work. I mean, to begin to divide up this money, it's not enough. If we were talking about, you know, $2 million here, obviously, then we'd be able to rank them as far as what we heard, and housing was number one. It sounds like there's some of that process that's going on with some of the collaborative groups and other agencies. My recommendation would be that these components are a part of any application. And it may be that you have a program. It may not be evidence-based, but it may be based on somebody's really trying to program. They're not calling it mentoring, they're calling it coaching. It really makes sense, and it seems to that group that it would be something that would fill a gap or be a big investment. I would think people that are in this line would be looking for ways to either to kind of bridge that gap they may have in services due to lack of funding. I mean, that's something we'll turn over to the executive committee to make that decision. But I would see it as one application, and it could be multiple sites are funded or not.
So what you're saying is that each group just
it wouldn't be each group.
Provide for each, well, CBO or whatever, right, they provide an RFP that whatever they do, it could be one or two, three, four of these items. And then this, the group that you suggested to look over, see which ones maybe the most encompassing, the most beneficial to the department, and just pick out those to, okay, to award the money. Okay, I think I understand that. Supervisor Goh.
Thank you, Chairman. So this would be for the allocation for the approximately $671,000 that's available for
us. I think it was
800
or something, wasn't it, Dr.
Waterman?
I think it was 800 and something thousand.
And then we have already allocated a considerable amount to mental health, substance abuse, and how does that play in? And you're subcontracting that also to some CBOs.
To CBO, sure.
Yeah, can you elaborate maybe on
sure,
that
with I'll repeat what is probably verbatim in the minutes from the I hate to make quick comments because they'll appear in these minutes.
Yeah.
At any rate, you know, it's not our intent to use this $1 million to supplement what's already going to mental health and substance abuse for treatment. So if we do include the substance abuse in there, it might be more in terms of supportive linkage kinds of activities around substance abuse or providing a venue for 12-step on site or those sorts of things that would supplement.
I couple of comments that I wanted to make. As your county alcohol and drug program administrator, it's my job to make sure that the substance abuse treatment programs that operate in this county meet law. And there's a criminal there's actually a criminal penalty to delivering something called residential treatment if you're not licensed by the Department of Alcohol and Drug Programs. So I literally have to turn away when people talk to me about something like a faith-based that isn't licensed. And I go, you know, I usually have to go, I don't want to hear this, you know, when the judges say, but I really love Teen Challenge. And I'm like, I can't hear that because they are not licensed by the authority in this state that has the wherewithal to be able to license those programs. So truly, the allocation that came to Kern County Mental Health to purchase your substance abuse treatment is going to those certified licensed programs, number one. Number two, I monitor occupancy on a weekly basis, and I will tell you right now that I have all of 13 individuals that are waiting for a residential bed that have gone through the gate. That's it. And they're not lingering out there. They are actually sitting in a level 4 treatment program waiting to go up into a residential. So other than Mojave and I believe it's Mojave, Taft, and Ridgecrest, we don't have waiting lists. Your allocations will in fact increase capacity. So I would respectfully ask that you not consider purchasing substance abuse treatment services from that CBO dollar.
And that's why we thought the panel that should be screening these should be the experts. It may not be substance abuse. These are just the needs that were identified.
Oh yeah.
And I understand that. And I also think that if you do an RFP and it includes substance abuse, obviously you need to say that they're licensed, etc. These are just the needs. And I heard there are a lot of little pieces to making these things happen. I mean, it may not be jobs. It may not be a job skill program, but it may be the accessibility to get to the programs, whether it be transportation, whether it be the housing to be able to participate in the program. So, and that, again, that's why we think the people that should be looking at this RFQ or RFP and screening it, scoring it, should come from the field. Because I know when we do an RFP, I want an expert from, you know, Department of Human Services or Mental Health. If somebody's telling me they're going to provide some sort of service, right. I want a children's service person like Deanna Cloud say, well, wait a minute, we're already funding that, so this doesn't make sense to us.
And I think when we put that out, you can indicate that they will have to indicate if they're licensed or not by the state. And the actual dollar amount, the ongoing cost was $670,940. There's a one-time amount of $312,364, so it's a total of $983,304, so for this year. And that's just something that, but the one-time cost could be the process of doing the RFP or whatever, and then the ongoing cost could be funding the programs, whatever is selected. But that's just a suggestion, but that'll be up to this committee, I think, to decide that. I'm sorry, Assistant.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Cugay.
Yes.
We heard, for example, in Alameda that mental health didn't receive any of the funds. A question that I would have, Mr. Corson, is there a, not a clearinghouse, but is there information as to how counties throughout California have allocated dollars to community-based organizations to see if any consensus has emerged as to the appropriate allocation? And the reason I ask that is you mentioned that the question is how to divide up the money. And I think that also begs the question of how much money is needed. We've heard from Turning Point here today. We've heard from New Life. These community-based organizations are so extremely well-positioned, in my judgment, to address, for example, what we heard from Mr. Miracle, what the probation officers recognize is substance abuse treatment. It is temporary housing, but they're not going to be able to do their jobs unless they get adequate funding. And so I think, at least as it informs this body's deliberation as to next year's, if not this year's, allocations to community-based organizations, are we giving them enough? Should we be giving them more? Do other counties give them more? Alameda County may not provide as much money to the governmental aspect of mental health, but they may double or triple what we're providing to community-based organizations. I think the fact that they're here, they're not getting paid, they're not for profit, and this is really in their sweet spot, really cries out for us to really examine, are we devoting enough of the resources to their services?
And Mr. Moore, the plans from each of the county is available to the public. If you go to the CPOC website, each county was supposed to submit their plan, and it is posted, so it is open to the public. So you can look at each county's plan and how they divided up the money.
And was Chairman, are you by any chance in a position then to comment upon how Kern County's allocation to community-based organizations compares to the majority of other counties?
I know Becky and myself have looked at a lot of different plans, and especially the year ones. Not everyone's year two plans are posted yet, but I'm not sure what it is. It's a small percentage that give money to CBOs at all at year one. There's a lot of discussion about it, kind of like the same situation we were, where everyone talked about it, but it didn't what happened. So I don't think, from what I've read, there's no consensus of this is how everyone's kind of doing something different.
Right.
A lot of counties aren't doing anything at all.
Yeah, I think we're across the board, across the state on this. Some do none, some do a little bit more. I think we actually are on the higher end of giving money to mental health, CBOs, when you look at it, and for people saying we're a conservative county and we don't believe in treatment, I mean, I think we put more into that than most counties out there. But you can look at that. I did not look at all the plans, and like Mr. Miracle said, the second year plan, not all of them are posted yet, but as they go along, it should be on there, and you can check that and look and see.
Mr. Warren, that's one of the reasons why I included it. I mean, this is one of the more comprehensive, detailed outlines of what somebody's going to do with some CBO money with 8109. There are some clearinghouses that list and rank programs. They're evidence-based. We looked at that as well. I would be in full agreement with you that there are some organizations obviously here that I would expect full well would apply to be a part of that RFP, because they can get up and running, it's a short time frame, it's not a lot of money, and that additional dollars could really boost what they're already doing in the community. It would make sense that you would see some of these folks as applicants.
Well, and given that the Chairman's representation that Kern County is among the leaders in funding as a percentage of total dollars, community-based organizations, I think that is that's an important fact that's prominently featured.
And one quick question, if I could. Mr. Corson mentioned that I think it was Santa Clara was taking a portion of their dollars and applying it to evaluations. What you're suggesting, Ms. Alvarez, is that component is already in place, and as long as they're licensed, we don't have to go through that vetting process. So we could indeed just allocate the money strictly for the programs to get the biggest bang for the buck, as opposed to having to allocate anything for evaluation. Is that correct?
I would say that for substance abuse treatment in this county, yes, I do have the information that would tell you outcomes. So that's all right. You don't have to purchase anything more with substance abuse treatment programs that come through my division. I can tell you that.
Okay, thank you.
So, I'm sorry, Dee.
I just thought of something in relation to Tom's comment about the people who rank the request for proposal. Did you have a court on that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quite honestly, the judges are very familiar with all the programs. They're the ones who ultimately sentence, if it's into the court process, to the programs. I mean, they have that final say. I think that that component of this group should be represented.
And having a representative from the courts on this RFP subject.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, they're very familiar with all the programs. More familiar, to be honest, than probably in my office.
Mr. McNally?
I can certainly approach the subject with the judges. I will suspect that they will not get involved in any decision related to funding any organization, but they could and would certainly provide some insight on what type of needs they're looking for in court. But I doubt very seriously they're going to get involved in in allocating X amount to this particular CEO, et cetera. But
I think they just sit on the committee, maybe be a non-voting committee.
I think that would be great, and I will certainly broach the subject with the PJ.
Okay, and then we'll look at it at the PJ sitting as a non-voting member on this.
Or his designee.
which I believe will be you, Mr. McNally.
Right.
So. Okay.
I had a question, Mr. Corson.
Yes.
So I understand the process. So I understand we're going to say these are the eight needs. We have $980,000. Kind of a go out to the CBOs, what do you got for us kind of thing. I guess if I'm a CBO, I'd be a little confused. So am I presenting something for $980,000? Am I presenting something for $200,000? It's kind of all up to them
to decide.
Maybe
the language contract. I mean, I can share language that we utilize, Network for Children. We RFP money out. We'll RFP money out for a geographic region. Let's say it'll be, you know, $1.3 million in Metro Bakersfield to provide child abuse prevention and intervention treatment. Sometimes we will tie a formula to it if we specifically know what we don't want. If not, then that's the allotted amount, and it's really up to the screening body. But really, that becomes what the RFP looks like. We utilize county council and their template for the RFP, and that kind of stuff in detail can be spelled out in there. And again, I know it's a little abstract, and I didn't want to bring back to this group especially something abstract, but I think it's probably the best way to do it. My fear too is we continue this process and we get into November, December, and by the time, you know, the money gets out to these sites, they're already struggling, and we don't have any data or any information for this first district. But and I know it, and we're willing to provide what input we can to never bring the RFP.
Dr. Water.
I was hopeful that we could actually avoid an RFP, full RFP, which is going to be very time-consuming and costly, do more of an RFQ process for organizations that are already qualified to provide these services, but submit their qualifications, and then what you do there. I'm not an expert in count, and Mark, maybe you can help save me from myself on this, but that's a much faster process. We utilize that.
The game process with Project 180 stuff. That'd be an RFQ. It was quicker. It's less cumbersome. It's less detailed. So
I think that's an excellent idea, because also those other agencies that are aspiring to be a part of the process to understand what the requirements and qualifications are, they can start developing programs to meet those. And at least we have something heading in the right direction. So I think speedy and expeditious is probably makes a lot of sense.
So we've had, yes, Sturkerl.
I'd like to propose something just a little bit different, and that is that we only fund three things. That we only fund housing, that we only fund employment or vocational development, and we consider fees on a voucher. If individuals, I believe that, I know in my substance abuse system, persons are assessed for their ability to pay, but they are not denied for inability to pay. So that's why folks coming through our gate are screened for the potential of a grant paying for their service. They will be assessed for ability. They will be placed on a sliding scale. The fee for drug testing is probably more of a philosophical type of discussion. It's been an agreement between all of us that there is a certain amount of personal responsibility that we're asking defendants to take on. But we purchase the first 30 days of treatment, of drug testing for anyone in outpatient. I pay for the first 90 days of drug testing for someone that's in a level 4 in an intensive outpatient. And there is no drug testing requirements other than the programs internal for a residential stay. So I would like to take the drug fees off, but I do understand that, for example, parenting, domestic violence, some of those services in our county are provided in our county, but they are not funded by an agency, and so it requires those agencies to deliver on a pay-as-you-go kind of. And if we could consider, you know, subsidizing some of those services, I don't know philosophically what that does for the agencies, but at least we could have a conversation about helping to defray some of those fees, but employment and housing, and then just take a dollar amount and say, we're willing to spend in this year X amount for fees, we're willing to accept. But I'd just like to get it much more concrete. I'd like to get, I'm not comfortable with ambiguity around almost $1 million. I'd like to have a little more structure.
Well, you know, I would hate to tie our hands, I think, a little bit. I think that's what this review committee would decide. I mean, what is it that we want to do and want to fund? And I would hate to limit the community organizations from saying, well, if I don't provide those services, so I can't even apply for it, but there might be something that they can supply that would be useful to us. I wouldn't want to limit that at the very beginning, but as a group, when we look at this and we evaluate the proposals, and I like Dr. Waterman's RFQ, you know, process much better, but then look at them, and then that committee decides, okay, what is it we're going to fund? But I don't want to limit them at the beginning, and that's just my personal feeling. Dr.
The RFQ process works well when there's a clear qualification.
Right.
So somebody says, yeah, they meet the qualification.
Right.
Maybe a little tougher around when you throw everything in. I do think, though, that Lily's suggestion has merit, particularly if you look at job skills and employment readiness, and Verna, maybe you could address this. Sometimes GED, remedial studies, aggression replacement, cognitive behavioral skills, those are really related, I think, to job skills and employment readiness and can be folded into that kind of a program. So if somebody was saying, you know, submitting their credentials to do this, they could specify, we could make it clear in the RFQ that the ability to do those programs in the context of employment readiness would be a plus.
And I agree with that, but that still includes all of what Mr. Corson's committee.
Oh, I know. What I'm trying to do, though, is narrow it for the RFQ. I'm thinking ahead to how this thing will be written and
right.
how we actually do this. And if you're putting out eight things, then somebody that just does a DV program, a domestic violence program, turns in their qualifications, and you're going to be in the situation where you're going to have to say, well, yeah, they meet the qualifications, so we're going to fund them. That's the way an RFQ works. RFQ doesn't say eight people meet the qualifications, so we're going to pick that one. That's an RFP process. It's really a competitive selection process. RFQ is really designed to say, who out there can do this for us? We know there's not 50 organizations out there. There's probably eight that can do it. So if you qualify, turn it in, and we're going to contract with each of them to do some of what they're doing. That's the RFQ.
Right, and I believe narrow it down, but I don't want to narrow it down too much. But Supervisor, go together.
Yeah, I would recommend going broader. Tom was going back to the way the gang proposals were done during that time. When you're working with the community-based groups, there's such a range of services that are available, a range of capacity, that I think you want to give the committee greater flexibility in seeing what is actually proposed. And so I remember during that time, there wasn't any specific amount, dollar amount that was given. It's like, we're going to allocate X number of dollars, and whoever turns in their proposal, you give it your very best shot, and the evaluating committee will determine. In some cases, people were funded to fully what they requested. In other cases, just a very small portion, but each of the proposals just delineated what services were being able to be offered for X number of dollars, and then there was just greater flexibility in those making the decision to really look at what the needs are, what's already being funded. So I think that might give us a greater flexibility in meeting, in addressing the actual gaps in our community.
Mr. Moore, I'm going to have Director Cheadle, she had her hand up first.
And I just want to actually echo what Supervisor Goh just said. We actually did administer those prevention game grants, and we did use the RFQ process. And we said we had $1 million out there. Here's what we were going to look for in the agreements. Surprisingly, we did not have a big decision to make as far as how to allocate the money. All of the programs who submitted got a grant. It was more about how much each one of them got, but that was a very smooth process, and we continue to use it today.
And I'm not in disagreement with our Mr. Moore.
As it relates to the broad versus the more limited, I suppose I would adhere and be a subscriber to the broad. In that, it seems to me to be a little bit anomalous to suggest there are areas where only government is best positioned to deliver services. But as it relates to the agenda item, maybe this, if Mr. Chairman would consider, is referring this to the committee to discuss and provide a recommendation to the full board.
And that's what I was getting at. I wanted to get the comments first, but we would have somebody come up with a recommendation to present to the executive committee, and then we would have public comment. But I just wanted the comments out here first.
This is our recommendation.
Okay. And can you kind of state that?
Our recommendation is that, and I agree with the RFQ. I mean, I think language RFQ eventually was one of the things that was included in the recommendation for us. I just didn't include here, and I apologize for that. But an RFQ does make more sense, but an RFQ be issued based on the available dollar amount that tries to focus or target these eight things, understanding that if I'm not a substance abuse program that's licensed through mental health, and there may be no reason for me to apply, but that was the goal of having that panel that could vet these RFQs. For instance, the last one, number eight, bridging services between custody and release, one of the things in research that we found was this idea of having a coach, or even, I won't use mentor because I doubt if I'm 30 years old I'm getting released from prison, I want a mentor. But what I saw a lot, especially from the Sheriff's Department, was this real desire to have things happening in the institution that would carry on these linkages. Linkages have already funded substance abuse or therapeutic programs, linkages to jobs, and that may be a different organization or agency.
And that's part of, I think, what we do too, is when they get released or placed under our custody, it's our officer's job to try to provide that linkage also to service.
Yeah, it's a limited amount of money. If you were to ask me, the one thing I heard from everybody throughout, housing is a big issue. But $1 million isn't going to go a long way. And sometimes housing is built into these programs. But if I'm dealing with, if I'm somebody that's on medication, I have mental health issues, I'm on the street, I'm probably going to get picked up by one of Greg's guys tonight. But if I'm in a stable environment, I'm making my appointments, I'm taking my meds, someone's checking on me, I'm going to be stable. But I think our recommendation, and I'm looking at that.
Yeah, if you could just state maybe just a recommendation
Subcommittee recommendation, AB 1059 is available to meet pre- and post-release inmate services needs or limited measurable outcomes are expected. It is recommended that a RFQ, not an RFP process, invite CBOs to submit proposals limited to the eight service types above. And the scoring process be utilized to identify which proposals hold the most promise to improve local outcomes. Proposals that receive the highest scores basically are successful.
The RFQ can do that.
Right? Well, the RFQ may not use a scoring system. It may use a... there was a point system. I'm reflecting back to last RFQ.
You can still use a scoring system in the RFQ.
It's a scoring system. It's not as complex as an RFQ. So Services will be provided by an ACCB over the capacity and experience necessary to successfully implement and evaluate them. So if I'm applying for substance abuse, I better be licensed? No?
Well, we already fund substance abuse treatment.
If the executive group wants to pull substance abuse off this,
that's your recommendation.
Yeah, that's my recommendation includes substance abuse.
I think when we talked about substance abuse, it was more the fact of the in-house substance abuse. There seems to be a lack of those types of facilities for where they have to come and stay. They have to stay there. They can't. It's not. I come on Monday and Tuesday. I actually come and I live there while I'm getting treatment. And then
SLE.
Is that what
it's
sober
living?
Yeah.
Sober living.
Yeah, I mean, our recommendation would, that's why we wanted to be able to have the executive board, obviously, have a full list of what we kind of gathered from the information we have been provided.
I'd move that submit the recommendation to the executive board for further action.
Okay. All right, that is the recommendation and a second now for public comment. If we would like to comment on that.
You want to go first?
Yeah.
No, okay. Go ahead.
All right, sorry. I was already out of my chair. Okay, I'm Kim Albers. I feel like a lot of hats. That you guys talked about a lot, and I was making notes as I went, so I'm going to try and go really fast. We'll say Garden Pathways, how about that? I think talking about the funding discussion about how the $1 million maybe be more than other counties were doing, I really think we've talked about before how we're making up for the underfunding for years and years and years. So really, would hate to see there be a movement towards, $1 million is too much money, because I think that we're making up for years and years of history of these organizations being underfunded. Also, for the ex-offenders here, I just really wanted to say that there were 300 ex-offenders surveyed over the last 18 months through the Bakersfield Safe Streets Partnership, and we included that data in what we gave to Tom, and so these same things that are listed came up on that list. And so I want to assure you guys that ex-offenders' voices were heard in the process. So I think that was really important to state. Mentors are needed. I guess that was the other thing. I think even for 30-year-old men, we'd all agree that that bridge from pre-release to post-release is essential. And then just really being in the housing, homelessness being my major hat, which is not Garden Pathways, thinking that there's a lot of blurred between what we just discussed, between transitional housing, which is why I think what we call sober living homes, and residential substance abuse treatment. And those terms are being interchangeably used in our discussion and so I think there's a lot of confusion. So if there is a RFQ process for housing, I think it's just, like you say, for the experts to make sure that that there's a delineation between sober living homes. It sounds like what I'm hearing is for residential substance abuse treatment, there's only a waiting list of 13, but for sober living homes, that's something that the probation officers and many stated was a huge need. So again, just very different terms, probably very different qualifications. So just wanting to make sure that, we don't sort of recommend something that that in the semantics of it is really not going to be fundable. So housing, I think, is SLEs, and residential substance abuse treatment is something else. So very, very important to make a distinction there. Also, I think that there are many organizations, Stay Focused, New Life, Garden Pathways, and many others in the community that to fill the needed gap for intervention services and post-release services have been stepping in to fill those gaps. And so I would hate to see an RFQ process eliminate some of those evolving programs that are doing amazing work. And so while I totally understand the negative of going through sort of a full RFP, I wonder if it somehow could be where it's not just sort of a finite group. I think I've tried to be the voice of community-based organizations here at this level. And so what I hear right now, and I think why I'm kind of shaking, is just that organizations that I have watched, you know, really try to meet the gap in this population might not even be allowed to present a proposal. So I guess I would just really urge the panel to make sure that the RFQ slash RFP would include those promising practices, those who have been doing the work but maybe are not licensed in some of these other areas. So I know there's many others now that want to talk, but I do agree with, and I've stated it here before, that the substance abuse treatment is in the other line item. And so really encourage us to keep investing, as I do believe it is one of the biggest needs. But the actual residential substance abuse treatment line is in the mental health category. And so very much agree with the statements made there that the CBOs are for this other residential substance abuse treatment that isn't, you know, that we wouldn't call that. So, all right, thank you.
Chair, could I just a couple things. One, thanks, Kim, for bringing up the Safe Streets data. We've been the one collecting the data internally, so we had a wealth of information that was taken from people that were involved in the Safe Streets process. Extremely helpful, and one thing that's not on here is dental is a big thing when you get out.
Dental is a big thing.
As far as the mentoring was really what they've begun to call it is coaching, which I thought was cool. And Santa Clara has a neat model for that you might look at. But when it comes to the sober living and residential, I'm mixing those two. It's not my world.
Right.
What we heard was it was the kind of the mom and pop sober living homes that was a barrier. And there was even...
Because of fees.
There was the fees, yeah. And then also even the insurance liability with the county occurred. I mean, that's a policy thing. But they felt that the, I don't know if it's like $2 million or whatever, liability insurance was a barrier for them. And some of them may even go out of business because of it.
Right.
So that, again, thank you for clarifying that. The residential really didn't come up. It was more the sober living mom and pop, which Pat referred to.
Where everyone saw there was a critical need. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely. So those bridging services, I think, again, are being called mentoring, coaching, where they have someone that's really walking them through.
Yeah. So. From pre all the way to post.
Pre to post. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mr. Kugie, if I could, just for my clarification, as I understand it, Mr. Corson's recommendation was to include mental health on the working group. So I envision them keeping us honest. If there is a discussion about duplicative expenditures, they're going to say, no, we've already got that covered as we review this RFQ. So I think the process encourages some oversight of those dollars, and I don't have the same concern that we're going to spend money for the same purposes. So I think the way Mr. Corson has proposed it is that it's an all-inclusive process, and we have folks that can help us make sure that we're not misusing the money that we have allocated.
Well, and it just sounded like in the audience that after Ms. Alvarez very much explained the difference in residential substance abuse treatment and that there wasn't a waiting list, there were several people that still use that term as a critical gap in services. So that's where I think it sounded like we weren't responding to their expertise. So that's why I want to make sure I brought it up again.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Ms. Castillo.
I just want to support what Kim is saying. She said everything really good. I just wanted to add to that and hope that there is some kind of bidders conference so that CBOs can come together and really hear what it is when the RFP, all the pieces get together, you guys figure out if it's going to be an RFP or RFA or RFQ. Whatever is going to be when all of that gets figured out, that community agencies are then notified and said, look, we're having a bidders conference here. We're going to explain to you what it is that we're looking for, how to apply, and the money that's available and where you need to focus. So that's the main thing. And then this whole issue around substance abuse, I think that when we were in all of our discussions and with probation, with the sheriff's department participating and with ex-offenders themselves, is the issue of sobriety, you know, in terms of, you know, it's not the actual treatment itself or the SLE, it's this whole issue of sobriety, which is the underlying, which is the symptom of all the stress, all the problems, everything that they have to meet is this whole thing of staying sober and sobriety. So agencies like NA who actually assign a sponsor
to that person that can help them stay on the track, it's really important to be included in that more so than I would say in treatment. So when we're talking about substance abuse, let's also remember that it's sobriety that we're trying to get at, you know, that will help them the most. And then also to remember pre-release services is real critical. That's one of the things that we came up with in our group is this whole thing about, and the Sheriff's Department was really helpful in really helping us understand how that works, is really some pre-release stuff, getting that person connected to services, understanding what he's gonna do before he gets out. And there's a lot of things that go along with that. Identification, having an ID, some kind of ID, your social security card, something like that. Those little small things put in place ahead of time before that person gets out. And so anybody that's interested or wanted to really make a difference, is include that pre-release piece in there. And, you know, because once they get out, I mean, it really sets us back a long time to order a birth certificate, to order an ID, to order a social security card. So a lot of the pre-release stuff, so if you can remember to be thinking in terms of pre-release too.
I just have to say, you know,
please state your name again.
Brenda Ray. I was really shocked to hear there was 13 people waiting on your list, because I am a part of Narcotics Anonymous. I am a sponsor, and I have a sponsor. I understand that relationship, and I can tell you there's thousands out there that are under your radar. They are under your radar. We see them every day. They're sleeping under those bridges because they didn't get that program. They didn't get whatever, that little bit of whatever they needed is there. They don't have that. They don't have the money for the sober living because they can't get the job. And it takes them a minute. And I'm gonna tell you, a lot of times when they get out, and I'm talking probationers, not just, you know, not just parolees, I'm talking probationers also. And it's very few that get out and don't hit the streets and get loaded first. So if you need to be clean before you go into that program, they're not gonna make it. But we see them every day come in to Narcotics Anonymous, and they're just lost because they're under all of your radar. There is nothing for them because they're on probation and there's no longer funding, or they're, you know, they're not able to pay for that program that they've gotten, that Prop 36 or whatever with the testing and all of that. So just while you're making this discussion, just remember those people. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ray.
Hello, my name is Walter Wayne. How are you doing, Tom? And I know pretty much a lot of you here. And the reason I'm here mostly is to make sure that this gets done right for a change. All right? Because we've been doing it for years. And one of the biggest problems we have is, you said it yourself, pieces. It's not going to continue to work with pieces. These need to be housed under one roof where these guys can make it. They'll tell you themselves, if I can go to one place, like you got DHS for women and pregnant and for children, you got ETR, unemployment and homeless, so who you ain't got a job. People who need a second chance, who have made a mistake in their life, whether they've been to prison or not or jail, they need a place where they know it's for them. If I know there's a place for me to go when I know I made a mistake, you talk about substance abuse and all these type of things, I would go there on my own. Substance abuse is only effective when the client is ready to do it. Because he's gonna do everything he have to do to make sure that he does it. Because he's tired. It's like they tell me, I'm tired. Well, when you're tired, you'll quit doing what you're doing, you won't be talking about it. You'll know when you're tired. If we can put this under one roof, it'll be cheaper for everybody. We need education, we need drug rehab, because how are we gonna get them ready for a job when they got drug problems? Can't pass a drug test. They got mental issues. How are we gonna send them when they got mental issues? Some of them need help. Some of them might need SSI and SDI. They need that evaluation. Everybody can't work the oil fields. Some of them need GED, some of them need high school, or some might want to go to college. We need to assess them, evaluate them. We need also vocational job, different ones. We need, that's part of the program. You want to house and help these people that made these mistakes, they all need to be under one roof. These evaluation needs to be done dealing with these individuals. Now, I'm not talking about some of my normal. Y'all have a structure that comes off of statistics, that comes off of what you do. But let me tell you something. You do not know what makes that person go or whether you're the first or the last thing they need in their life. Okay, let's get this straight. You don't have a clue. All you know that I work this program, I know some people need this. Not saying nobody's not doing a great job, but we need to go outside the box, that's all I'm saying. You have, you said mentors. To increase the success, these some of the same guys here, whether they gang members or people who done wrong, I need somebody to look like me, talk like me, been there and done that, to bring me across this bridge. Because they understand. You can have a PhD and send them into a substance abuse class or as a counselor. They run rings around that person all day long because they don't understand. They wasn't a part of it. They ain't been there and done that. They know their job is for us with the book game. But you gotta have somebody else there to help these people understand that you need this help. I used to do this and I changed, okay? I've been to prisons and I have used drugs. I work for GBLA now. Been there for 13 years. Okay, Tom know me, Lisa know me, Lily, Ms. Cheatham, Ms. Cohn. I mean, my life has changed because I made the decision, it's time to do that. I have a family to raise. That quick money is not happening. All right? I'm not talking from a statistic, I'm talking from a true life story, and I deal with these people every day. I deal with Kim Alvarez, I didn't deal with New Life. I didn't deal with the people they don't even see. I deal with shooters, I didn't talk to them. My brother mostly do the work, but I have talked to them. They come to me occasionally for help, he accesses me for help. We have a facility right now that's very close to everything we need, where a person can live up to maybe 2 years. All the service providers can go up in there. There's a big kitchen in there. There's 40 rooms. And that's where it needs to be, where it's easy to access for all of them. And you have a better chance of getting these people off the street. I know realignment is totally different. We trial and error, that's how we're doing it. But to increase our chance of getting these guys off the street, we need one roof. Santa Barbara, you're talking about money. Santa Barbara got almost $2 million, a little over, for their grassroots leaders. That's when the first year I looked into it. We all might be, I don't know what it is this year, how competitors across the board this year, but I know people was kind of giving it out at first. I don't know how it is now. But money is needed. And then if you want to evaluate the programs that's in there to make sure they are meeting the needs of what the people are doing, evaluate. And those who come in to free, let's say, but they planning on getting in the next go around, they should be evaluated. First, you need to participate. You talk about some of the requirements, that's what it should be. But we need what's going to fit to help these individuals increase their success rate. And it's not what we've been doing. I've been saying this for years. We have gang money that never go to gang money. They go to big after school program. Is it dealing with the people in the street that doing the shooting? No. Is it dealing with the people who, the kids who's out of school, who's actually in gangs? No. They deal with kids in school. They halfway got the structure. Whether it's good or bad, they halfway got the structure. But we need to get the kids that's not going to school because they are recruiting the kids who's having trouble. You understand what I'm saying? And this is, and another thing that really would help these guys increase, and I just think about it. Which one of y'all will hire an ex-con?
I will. With limitations and qualifications.
But yeah, maybe one out of two, but overall you won't. Let's just be honest about it. Don't sit here and act like this is what's going on. I will. You won't. But if that individual had credibility that has showed you that they've been in the program for 6 months or a year, all right, they had to build that credibility. Just be honest about it. And if all of y'all on the board can say, well, he's been in my program for 4 months, Lily said that. Tom said he's been doing this for 3 months, and on and on and on. Then that private business man, I said, well, I hire him because he showed that he'd been there for 6 months and he got some of these great names behind him. And yeah, why not take a chance on him? But they had to build their credibility. How are they going to do that? How are they going to be able to get a chance if we don't make a place where they can go get a chance? Make a place where they can do this. So all I'm saying is to just overlook the whole thing, and we've been missing it for years. We can't keep doing pieces. We got to do it under one roof. And all these different things can go under one roof. Because it ain't no one or two or three. It's several things that have to be there to make it happen. So I'm just asking y'all to just look at it and think about it.
Yeah, Mr. Kavinsky.
Yes. Mr. Williams?
Oh.
Mr. Moore has a question.
I'm not sure I understood. Or I understand when you say it's all got to be under one roof. Because, for example, Turning Point and New Life are both outstanding programs, but they're different programs. And similarly, if you look at it in terms of categories, they're specialties. And wouldn't it be too much to expect a single provider to be all things to everyone?
I never said one provider.
That's
one.
What I'm asking. I'm
is they housed under one roof? You have, for instance, let's take the 180. All of them different program, but they all house on the roof. That makes it very accessible for each individual to go to where they need to go to get help. Studying them trying to travel way over there, which they ain't gonna make it, to way over here, which they ain't gonna make it, they're gonna give up, get tired. If they're all right there, and we send them referrals to each other, showing not only you that we doing our job, but now we can get a better understanding of what's needed to be done and how we can better assess them and give them help.
So how do you do that?
You how? You put it on the roof. Yes, you got, like I said, you got 180. Just put it all on the roof. Put all your resources that you evaluate that is needed for individuals to become positive in society again. You put it under one roof.
What do you mean?
Well, may I come alongside this gentleman and say what I think I see? We're talking about when business does business in a government building, okay, you've got the district attorney's office is going to be at the court, okay, you put it all under one roof, your services.
Right.
Is that what you're talking
right.
about?
Right.
You put your services in one building, okay, now perhaps from Garden Pathways or Turning Point or one of these places, they're sending a shuttle over with people in it to go to that building, and they go from this appointment to that appointment to that appointment, and they're being triaged through a system.
Right. And so you just stay, it's better access. All the services that is needed for my success is under one roof. Like I said, DHS have all the services for women with children or pregnant, where they can be able to take care of their child and be able to, that's all I'm saying. Thank you, Ms. Warren.
Thank you.
Again, Sonia Jeffrey from New Life, residential. Another example of that would be what we're providing or what we're seeking to provide through the residential facility at New Life. We have a 40-bed capacity, we have a community resource room, we have vocational training on site, we have case management, we have the community resource room is set up to allow outside agencies that provide support services that we don't provide to have access to the individuals that are residents at the facility. We can provide transportation support, but as Mr. Williams said, having a one-stop capability and a centralized intake process and the means to be able to link individuals with the resources and eliminating the barrier of transportation by having those services in one place will increase the probability of success for the individuals because the services that they need are there.
Okay, thank you. Any other public comments? I see none. Okay, we do have a recommendation and a second to move to the executive committee. Let's have a roll call vote.
We have a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, comment from the committee.
Would you entertain a friendly amendment to change substance abuse treatment to substance abuse sobriety support?
Okay.
game. No, seriously, you guys are the experts. Well, you know, yeah, no, I hear what they're saying. Yeah, no.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's substance abuse sobriety support.
That's good.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Recognize, and I interpret that comment to relate to Ms. Alvarez's remark regarding certification or licensing. But aren't there programs, CBOs, within the community that are licensed providers?
Sure.
And so wouldn't that amendment cut out those licensed providers from eligibility for their services? And that goes back to why limit or why exclusively grant the government or the county government a monopoly on providing those services if there's licensed and qualified private providers? And I mean,
let me just respond. I believe that my side of the allocation that came from the CCP is approximately $1.6 million. I want you to know that 95% of those dollars go to community-based organizations. None of it stays in my department.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So we could have presented even our CCP to say, hey, here's $1.2 million already going to CBOs. It's a matter of how you present the information, but all of our dollars go out.
That assuages my concern.
Okay. So we do have a friendly motion, or friendly amendment to the recommendation. Any other comments from the committee? Yes.
Before the vote takes place, I just want to mention that Sheriff Youngblood had a family emergency, I believe, so we're representing
him. Okay, thank you. Supervisor Gould.
Just a comment. One of my observations in dealing both with government and CBOs is that in government, we tend to have programs that have an end, just because of the very nature of the funding. Whereas with the CBOs, they have the capacity and the desire and the passion to keep following that individual through for the long term. And I really believe that that should be weighted heavily in thinking through the long-term solutions in dealing with the root issues that really are at the heart of change. And so I am very supportive of the funding that we're given, that we're giving them. And I would encourage those of you who would be on the evaluation committee to look at the capacity for long-term change and change of the root and addressing the root issues, because that's the big difference in what we in government are able to offer versus what they're able to do with long-term change, making that transition, bridging what we're able to do, but in the long term, when we really see change down the road, and then also evaluate organizations on their ability to have done that in the past, demonstrating the ability for long-term substantive change. Thank you.
And I do agree with that, and I believe that's why Director Alvarez, I think most of her money goes to the CBOs because they do have that long-term plan for them and they do follow them. And I do believe in that because you can't just put them through a program and they cut them off and they're lost. So I do agree with that. So, but we do have a recommendation with a friendly amendment on that and a second.
Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments? Yes.
Are the makers of the motion and the second in agreement with the friendly amendment?
I am, yes.
I'm not sure who made the second.
Yes.
It was Lisa Green, yes. And you're in agreement with the friendly?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Is there other comments from the committee? A roll call vote, please.
Chief Kuge?
Yes.
Mr. McNally for Jim
yes.
Bush?
Yes.
District Attorney Green?
Yes.
Mr. Moore for Public Defender Titus?
Yes.
Sheriff Youngblood or Rosemary Wall for Sheriff?
Yes.
Dr. Waterman?
Yes.
Chief Williamson?
Yes.
Director Alvarez?
Yes.
Director Cheadle?
Yes.
Executive Director Corson?
Yes.
Supervisor Gill?
Yes.
Director Lewis?
Yes.
Superintendent Lizardi Frazier is not here. And Division Director Merrickle?
Yes.
Okay. This recommendation for the amendment will be moved on to the executive committee. Item number six, CPOC dashboard report, Ms. Jameson.
Okay. I know we still have quite a bit of an agenda to go through, so I'll make it as quick as possible. But I wanted to bring this to the CCP's attention because it's very important. The Chief Probation Officers of California, or CPOC, has recently come out with their statewide reporting of the initial 6 months of realignment. They have currently 13, that probably is going to go up, data elements that they're tracking. And they did a data dashboard that is now online, and the information is provided in the back. I was going to have that to you today, but I didn't want to mess with all that. So we can move through the agenda. But on the last page, it shows you what that data dashboard looks like, also where the information is located, as well as a brief, which I'm referring to, where they discuss the information. Basically, the gist of it is there's still not enough information to do comparisons, but the nice thing about the website is based on those 13 data elements, you can look at other counties and where Kern County stands, as well as they've even kind of generalized some of the areas in California, for example, the Bay Area, Northern California, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Southern California, I think Central Valley for the others. So it's kind of interesting when you go, it's very interactive, you know, just clicking on the information to kind of see where we're at. And the brief goes into more detail of the information that they found out. And some of the data elements are things such as the number of those that have been sentenced under the 1170H, which is the split sentencing options. And it's kind of interesting, some of the things that come up. And also where counties are in terms of the number of post-release offenders that are coming into their county versus, you know, the estimate. Of course, Kern County is still very high. We're way above the estimate at this time, and we continue to be, and I'll show you that in the data trackers. In many other counties, they're even below estimates, so it's kind of interesting to see where the information is falling, or the data is falling. In terms of each county. So I highly recommend that you go to that site. Keep in mind, this is only the first 6 months. They are working on the last quarter, April, May, and June, as we speak. We've already submitted that information to them. And they're the first group, and probably there would be several others, but people are looking to them to actually have some kind of data or statistics statewide by county. So it's kind of interesting. I strongly, like I say, encourage you to go to the website and take a look at that. So I just wanted to provide that information to you.
Thank you, Ms. Jamison. And if I didn't, I forgot to apologize, Mr. Lee. Thank you very much for your assistance on number five. But we will move on to item number seven, which is the financial summary report.
Okay, the financial summary report is actually nothing new. We've already talked about where the money stands. We've already gone ahead of this. This is just the formalization of that in terms of the amount that was unexpended for each of the funded departments. And we've already discussed, of course, carryover and what we're going to do with that. Nothing has changed. It's the same numbers. So this is just putting it into the report, and you have the information. Hopefully next year what we're going to do is maybe some comparisons too. It's going to be a little difficult in terms of how we're spending our money and how much, but at this point we're keeping it simple because there's just not a whole lot to report on that. So did anybody have any questions on that?
Amy.
Yes.
Are we tracking any expenditures departments might have had that are not covered by AB-109 funding? I know the board had asked about that when we first started this process. I was afraid there might be expenses that weren't going to be covered by the money. Has anybody encountered that yet? Is it just not happening, or are we not tracking it, I guess, is my question.
I don't think we've had anything from insurance office.
Yeah, from probation either. I don't think we've had any additional expenses.
I think because we didn't expend the money.
Yeah.
That there shouldn't be, but, you know, it's possible. But now that you're putting it out there, maybe for this year going forward, too, it's something that we
And maybe when we take the report to the board.
Or unfunded departments.
Mentioned so far, we've been able to cover our.
Right, and unfunded departments, those who aren't, yes, maybe are impacted, and Director Cheadle might be commenting on that.
Yes. Okay, Director Cheadle.
We are tracking, and we have had some impact, but it's been minimal. It hasn't been as much as we had anticipated. We had anticipated that we would see it in the general assistance program, and where we are seeing it is in the CalFresh food program.
Okay, well, I think when we take our report back to the board, we might want to include some of that. Maybe you and I can go back. Yeah. Do you remember the board meeting? It was like right when you first started?
Yes.
It was like Becky's second day.
It's the second day. Is there Supervisor Go might recall specifically.
I think there were also questions about medical costs, so you might follow up with KMC.
Yeah, we will do that. Okay, any other comments from the committee? Any comments from the public? All right, then I do need a motion to receive and file the report given by Ms. Jameson.
Motion.
Second.
We have a motion by Director Miracle, second by Dr. Waterman. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, we will move on to item number 8, which is the key data tracker report. Ms. Jameson, you're up again.
As you've seen these before, we have these for the first 6 months, and based on, I believe it was Ms. Alvarez's comment regarding keeping the consistently the same data, at least for now, we've done that. And in the interest of time, what I would like to do is just kind of point out a couple of things, but if any of the departments have anything specifically, they might want to add to that, I would certainly appreciate them doing that as well. We have, as everybody knows, right here you have 5 data trackers that we've reported on. It looks very similar to before. We kind of did, and I apologize for this, a little bit different in terms of some of the departments. For example, the Sheriff's Department, they actually, instead of fourth quarter numbers, they reported October through June. Because of our data collection capability, it was easier to do that. 2 is it kind of gives you more of a sense of kind of what's going on to date. Especially in the Sheriff and Probation Department, the impact has been so great. And I think to compare quarter to quarter has been kind of difficult for us to do. We're looking at what's happened throughout this first year of AB-109 implementation, but certainly next year going forward, it will be a little bit more detailed than that. And it, very similar things are happening as we go out or go throughout our first year we just completed is the number of non-non-nons, parole violators, still fairly high. And then also, I think what's interesting to note for the sheriff too, as well as the reported crimes, and then also those that have been released on programs from jail, which are really important, which is actually being looked at throughout the state. It's a key element or a key issue among the state in looking at what alternatives to incarceration, and then also any, especially pre-trial, inmates and how we're handling them. So I think it's really important to note that. And then what we're doing. This is great. And from what I can see is new. There's the Sheriff's Department is using it quite a bit more. And I think that's an interesting statistic to note how much we're using those programs. So I don't know if anybody had any questions on the sheriff's or Rosemary, you had anything to add?
Yeah, we're just really focusing on what we brought forward at the beginning of this process, that we're really trying to use the programs to link the inmates upon release into the program so that they're much more successful to reduce recidivism. But as you can also see, one of the things that has really gone up in our facilities is people coming in that are in custody that are under the influence of narcotics. And that was something that we saw early on too, that people were deliberately getting arrested and so that they could bring drugs into the facilities, and that trend really hasn't changed, and we're having more problems than we had in years previous.
And certainly, yeah, it's a new dynamic. I know I see that and read about it consistently. Other counties, if not all of them, are dealing with a similar situation.
Just a quick question. As I understand the term recidivism, it's arrest divided by a certain universe. I can see the rearrest, but I don't know what the denominator would be. What number would we divide rearrest by to see what our recidivism rate is? Is it just the entire universe, or just those people that have been incarcerated?
It's a very good question. The definition of recidivism, there's probably at least 10 to 15 different definitions. And also within our own department, we probably have about 5 definitions. The sheriff has a different definition, so it just depends. The one that CPOC is looking at will be, which is not this one, because this could be for a felony, a misdemeanor, a violation, it could be anything. For CPOC, they've kind of narrowed it down to